Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Thursday, June 23rd of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, the Longmont Museum will host an event this weekend looking at the intertwined histories of the movement to abolish slavery and the early push for women's rights. Then, John Lindorf will be in the studio to interview the head of Boulder's Meals on Wheels. At the bottom of the hour, we have the BBC News headlines. Then it's A Public Affair with Tish Buford, followed by the Radio Book Club with Maeve Conran. At 9:30, Doug Gertner will be in the Denver studio to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first, these local and regional headlines with KGNU's Christian Garibay.
The city of Boulder has filed a motion to dismiss a recent suit brought by the ACLU that calls the city's camping ban unconstitutional. The lawsuit argued that Boulder's recent camping and tent ban violates provisions related to freedom to use public streets, cruel and unusual punishment, and other rights stated in the Constitution. Boulder attorney Luis Toro argued against the lawsuit, stating that the ban does not ban warm clothing and so does not violate civil rights. A new bus route will begin operating in hopes to connect Boulder and Lyons again. Luis Licon from KGNU has more.
The new bus connecting Boulder and Lyons via US 36 will begin operating on June 27th. The route will be replacing the Regional Transportation District's previous white route from Boulder to Lyons, which RTD suspended during the COVID-19 pandemic. RTD will fund the new Lyons Flyer, but the City of Lyons will be operating the bus. Passengers will not have to pay a fare to ride the line. The Lyons Flyer will operate 3 round trips in the morning and afternoon during peak commute times. Mayor Holly Rogan said in a press release that the new route will allow our residents greater flexibility to take care of their daily needs and plan trips to Boulder and beyond the updated Lyons Flyer. For KGNU, I am Luis Licon.
Boulder County residents want more funding for transportation, wildfire emergency response, and wildfire mitigation. That's according to the results of Drake Research and Strategy's annual public opinion survey released this week. Other major concerns identified in the survey are cost of living and rising homelessness. This has been a constant topic in the annual survey, but concerns spiked due to the impact the pandemic had on these issues. The Board of County Commissioners will hold public hearings on these issues if they refer to the ballot measures for this upcoming November election. Boulder County Public Health Executive Director Camille Rodriguez announced her resignation yesterday, which will take effect next Friday, July 1st. Rodriguez was the first Latina appointed as executive director of the department. She's held the position since June of last year after her predecessor retired. BCPH's deputy director Lexi Nolan will assume the role of interim executive director for 6 months until a permanent replacement is put into the position, although her time can be extended. The board of PCH will oversee the hiring process. The Colorado Avalanche won their third game of the Stanley Cup Finals Wednesday night. KGNU's Jimmy Searfoss has more.
More overtime heroics were on display Wednesday night after the Colorado Avalanche beat the Tampa Bay Lightning in Tampa Bay 3-2. The game was mostly in favor of the Lightning, who led the game for 2 full periods. That was until Avalanche center Andrew Cogliano scored in the third to tie the game at 2 apiece. And that's where the score would remain for the rest of the regulation time. This took teams into sudden death overtime, where the next goal would win the game. The Avalanche were swarming the Lightning's goal throughout the entire extended period, but that would come to an end when the Avalanche's Nazem Kadri scored the game-winning goal. It was unsure if Kadri was even going to play in the game. He had surgery on an injured thumb just 18 days before, yet he would be the one to put the Avs up 3-1 in the series. The Avs face off again against the Lightning here in Denver Friday night at 6 o'clock, where they could win it all. For KGNU, this is Jimmy Searfoss.
Expect cloudy skies and warm temperatures all throughout the Front Range today, as well as a slight chance of rain. In Boulder, a high of 88 and a low of 63. In Denver, a high of 90 and a low of 63. In Fort Collins, a high of 92 and a low of 60. Outside the Boulder studio, it's 61 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Christian Garibay.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. The Longmont Museum will be hosting an event this Sunday that examines one of the most important social justice movements in American history, that of the Underground Railroad and those who organized for the abolition of slavery. Speakers at the event will include Dorothy Wickenden, longtime executive editor of The New Yorker and author of The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. She recently stepped down from her role at the helm of The New Yorker after more than 25 years there. The event will also feature Ashley Lawrence Sanders, assistant professor of African American history at CU Boulder. I spoke with both women yesterday. The two of you will be part of a special program this upcoming Sunday, June 26th, at the Longmont Museum. What's the occasion and what can listeners expect?
We are going to be talking about both of our works, I hope. So as you mentioned, my recent book, The Agitators, which is about three women, three sort of unlikely friends who worked together on the Underground Railroad in the 10 years leading up to the Civil War. Their friendship extended until all of them died. And it was two women that most people have never heard of. I certainly hadn't before I began the project. Martha Coffin Wright, who was a housewife and mother of six. Frances Seward, the wife of Lincoln Secretary of State, William H. Seward, and of all people, Harriet Tubman. And they conspired together in upstate New York in the town of Auburn. And so my book is an exploration of these three women, how they got together, how three people who had absolutely no power, and with women in particular, and a fugitive slave among them, just were able to go under the radar and really help to create the Second American Revolution, which included women's rights and overturning slavery.
Ashley Lawrence Sanders, what are you working on?
I work on Black memory of the Civil War currently, but more broadly, I teach African American history, so I'm very excited to engage Dorothy about this book. I knew the names of Martha Wright and Frances Seward, know their stories as much in depth as I do Harriet Tubman, who figures very heavily in my own work and research. You know, I think there's a weird thing where we know a lot about Harriet Tubman. We think we know a lot about her. We know her name. And I think that Frances and Martha have this friendship with her. I think exposes a lot about what we may or may not understand about current activism. And, you know, when I write about memory, a lot of it is engaging sort of these past ideas and how they can help inform the present. And I think that's sort of this important connection between my work and what Dorothy does here in this book is, you know, what can we actually glean from this kind of radical revolutionary friendship between these three women, these three very different women? And I think about that a lot because my students care about that. You know, they often care about how the past informs the present. And it's definitely, you know, in a lot of my work about memory as well.
I, too, had never heard of Martha Wright or Frances Seward. And Dorothy, you gave us a quick overview about who they are, but how did you come to know their stories and want to dig deeper into what it was all about?
I knew quite a bit about Auburn because that was where my grandmother grew up. And that was the subject of my first book. And amazingly, when I was working on that book, I found out that when my grandma, when she was about 5 years old, she and her best friend were standing on South Street, which is where the Seward House Museum is and where the Seward's lived at the time. And she and her friend were 4 or 5 years old, and they saw Harriet Tubman pass by as a very elderly woman. And when I was working on that book, that story, I couldn't get it out of my mind. And I kept thinking, how did Harriet Tubman, who was enslaved on the Eastern Shore for 27 of her early years, end up spending almost 50 years after the war in Auburn? So I kept thinking about that. And then I started looking into archives and started reading some of the scholarly books about Harriet Tubman. And I realized that I couldn't tell her story, and I didn't want to, without telling the story of these other two women too, because they worked together so tightly as collaborators. And in order to understand how revolutions are made, you have to understand the people who are making them. And in that era, it was these very unlikely people. And that, so nobody paid any, people had utter scorn, contempt for women in general and Black women in particular. So they could do quite a lot without people knowing what they were up to.
And Dorothy Wickenden, as executive editor of The New Yorker, you, of course, focus on news and current affairs. But why spend your extra time looking into and documenting history?
First of all, I'm just interested in American history. I didn't learn much about it when I was in college, or certainly not in high school. And so I got very interested when I was working on that book, which was my first book, which took place during the kind of settling of the West. So that got me into sort of telling history in a narrative way. And when I was working on this book, which took me 7 years because of my full-time job and other things, it was a complicated story, I kept being struck by how applicable their concerns were to today. It was spousal abuse. It was, the women, the level of misogyny was completely out of control. Men were allowed to beat their spouses, legally allowed to do that. Of course, racism was completely endemic, even in the North, where they were very proud because they had abolished slavery, years earlier, but it was a completely racist society. Frances Seward and Martha Wright both lived in Auburn, which was a very conservative town. And people who knew some of Martha's activities called her a very dangerous woman because she openly promoted full equality between Black people and white people. And that was, at the time, a completely revolutionary idea. So I think, as Ashley clearly does, that in order to understand what this country is going through now, an upheaval that I think could be just as serious as the upheavals that led to the Civil War, you have to know where all this sprang from.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, Lawrence, Sanders, anything in particular strike you about this book?
Oh, well, a lot. I mean, I read this book in one day, which, is pretty impressive for me in the summertime. But I process a rereading because I like to sort of reread because I'm going to be in conversation. And one of the things I caught a rereading is just how much I think Dorothy really focuses on the inner lives of these women, which I really appreciate because I think that has to be necessarily a part of writing women's history in particular. And speaking of this modern conception, just the struggles that these women had as women who were interested in activism, but having to balance the societal expectations that were placed on women, even middle-class women, right? That they be in the home, that they be good mothers, that they be good wives, right? And like the frustration they inevitably felt by being sort of kept in their place and breaking out of that frustration, right? Refusing the sort of patriarchal chains that society has placed on them, even in progressive circles, right? Even in the most radical circles that these things still exist. That's one of the things that struck me. And I think one, I was always sort of fascinated even before I read the book about the title Agitators, because I love that title. Like this is just, it's forthright, it's confrontational. And I think that that's exactly what abolitionists were. I mean, we don't know a lot about abolitionist history, which I consider probably the first major human rights movement, first major social justice movement we had in this country. And they were not well-liked, right? They were not well-liked people. They were small in number, but they were loud. And they were determined and they had moral clarity. And I think that that's sort of an important lesson for our time too. So when we think about activism, they're always a loud, pushy people, right? That like seem to make everyone uncomfortable. That's what abolitionists were. And I think Dorothy's book really highlights like what it is to live a life where you could be labeled a dangerous woman or be shunned, you could be killed. Like this was the reality for many abolitionists as well. Their lives were constantly in danger. I think this book really highlights what it takes to be Harriet Tubman, a Black woman who was enslaved and to come to this position, but also to be women, white women of relative privilege to set that aside and to be in sort of a revolutionary partnership and solidarity in a movement for struggle for women's rights and for emancipation inevitably. So I think this book really highlights the stakes for social justice movements. And I think that may be appealing to a lot of people today, hopefully.
What is the importance of bringing these types of events and discussions to the Boulder County area?
I think it's important. I think Boulder sees itself as a relatively liberal, progressive place, right? But a mostly white space. And I think that's been confronted a lot, over the last several years, including on campus. And I think that, people who say, I'm in this particular space, what can I do? you know, we have just such a small population, things are fine here, right? I think, you know, talking about places like, you know, Auburn, even places like Philadelphia, right? This is like the brotherly love, the freest city. And Philadelphia is a violent place for Black people. They burned down Pennsylvania Hall because it's an abolitionist venue. So you can see and confront these issues in your own backyard, even when you think you have the best sort of politics at the upper level that could exist, to imagine what it means, you know, for someone who does not look like you, who's not from the same background. And what are you as a person who's living and maybe relative comfort can do to better the lives of others? I think the women in this book, you know, really answer that question in a really like profound way.
My guests today have been Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker and author of the book, The Agitators, and Ashley Lauren Sanders, assistant professor of African American history at CU Boulder. They will be featured in a special program this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Longmont Museum. Thanks to you both. Thank you. Time now for Radio Nibbles. Food critic John Lindorf is in the studio with a special guest today, Francie Phillips, head of Boulder's Meals on Wheels. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Oh, good morning, Shannon, and good morning, everybody out there in Boulder and far beyond, gathered around the big KGNU breakfast table here. And you know, I've known about Meals on Wheels since since it started, and we're going to talk a little bit about what Meals on Wheels does, and also some of the challenges that are facing the organization. You're the CEO and have been at Meals on Wheels for how many years?
28 years.
Okay. in brief, what does Meals on Wheels do?
Meals on Wheels of Boulder is an independent Meals on Wheels program. There is no national Meals on Wheels. Every Meals on Wheels program is their own. They're independent, and we're one of those. And we deliver to about 250 people a day.
And like 5 days a week.
5 days a week.
And most of them are seniors?
Actually, we deliver to every age and every income. Because we don't receive any federal or state funding, everything is on the table. We can deliver to any age with no restrictions and any income, which we do. We serve a lot of people with chronic illnesses who are much younger, or they need help for just a little while. And of course, we have Project Homecoming, which is a transition from hospital to home. Program, so anybody can get 5 free meals, no strings, no cost, to meet any dietary restriction to help them adjust to being home after being hospitalized.
Meals on Wheels also has a lunch program at the East Senior Center.
At the West Senior Center, which is now called Agewell Center. Yes, we do. We have a restaurant called the Eat Well Cafe, and it was opened again after a 2-year hiatus last August, so it's growing and doing well. And in addition, a social venture to try and help fund Meals on Wheels, we created a small grocery store called The Niche Market. It meets a niche. And it is located in our new building that we spent 3 years in construction and building. And we've been there now for a little over a year, and the grocery store is located there.
So you have this major place in the care and feeding of Boulder, and it's a challenging time right now because of the rising price of food, and I think, you know, all of us notice because we grocery shop and buy gas that, you know, it's gotten much more difficult. But in the case of your organization, this is a major hit. You were saying your grocery bill had gone up dramatically monthly.
It has. Actually, you named it. Food costs have gone from $13,000, where we buy our food each month. So it was $13,000 at the beginning of the year, and it was $30,000 this month. So it's a huge increase in all of our food costs and in getting the food and the containers.
But it's things like chicken.
Chicken has gone up incrementally, and any pork or any beef, the protein that is such the major part of the meal that we send out, has been the greatest increase. And The other dilemma is we're having trouble getting some of the things. We plan our menus monthly for the clients, and for instance, getting pork, a certain kind of pork, we could not find at all. And it's just become a challenge now, and it's supply chain and whatever anybody is saying, to just get the foods that we need to send out to the clients to meet their dietary restrictions.
But you don't charge more.
We are not raising the cost to our clients. We charge anywhere from 50 cents up to $6.50, I believe. It's a sliding fee scale depending on what people can afford. The majority of our people make less than $20,000 a year, and that's strange for Boulder, but it is a true story. So there are a lot of people in Boulder who actually need help because they cannot prepare a healthy meal, and that's our job.
Right.
And we do use about 125 drivers a week. And
these are volunteers.
These are all volunteers.
And then we get to gas.
Yes, then we get to gas.
And you were saying that these are volunteers totally, and they're absorbing the cost of the gas.
They are. Not a single driver has asked for any help financially or to buy gas for their cars. They're just incredibly generous. They do not miss the beat. In fact, for the whole 2.5 years of COVID so far, we did not miss one day of delivering meals because every driver or substitute drivers stepped up to the plate. So where some programs across the country, Meals on Wheels programs, had to stop delivering because they couldn't or they had too much illness going on, we have been so very lucky to be able to continue to deliver meals every day.
And so how many volunteers does the organization?
We have about 400 volunteers who are active. They do kitchen prep work, they do driving, they help up in the office. Mostly they're drivers, and of course we always need drivers and volunteers if anybody out there is interested.
And well, let's talk about the ways that the folks who are listening can help now. One of them is by volunteering, obviously.
Yes.
For Meals on Wheels. But you're also in need of donations.
We really are. We are absorbing the cost difference in the price increases. And with the other challenges, we are not raising the prices, as we said, to our clients. So we're absorbing that difference. And it is becoming more and more challenging. And in addition, of course, we have a brand new building. And we're working to make that a viable place for people to come. So there are big challenges, and we certainly could use donations. And Boulder's been awesome in supporting us.
As you know, I have kind of a thing about pie. And for many years, I've been aware of you bake pies and quiches and have them available at the market, but you're also about to have a special July 4th sale.
Thanks for remembering that. We're having a Pie-merica pie sale, and that starts the 27th and runs through the 2nd of July. And pies will be 15% off, so it's a wonderful deal. They're all made from scratch in our kitchens, and we invite people to give it a try. They're frozen, ready to bake.
And so, I can vouch for their tastiness.
Oh, good. So can I.
Yeah.
It's been a challenge. Uh-huh.
We're going to wrap it up here, but I just wanted to thank you for what you do. And what's the easiest way for people to get in touch with Meals on Wheels of Boulder?
I think going online to www.mowboulder.org. mowboulder.org. And all the information is on our website and our phone numbers and how to reach me if anybody wants to talk to me directly. And I certainly thank you, John, and KGNU for letting me have this opportunity to tell about our organization. We love it.
It's great to see you again. We're going to wrap up Radio Nibbles now. And I wanted to, of course, in today's, this is a combination, today's Nibbles in the Boulder Weekly is a fun column. And it's also the best thing I've eaten lately. It's about grilled cheese, not grilled cheese sandwiches, but cheese you can put on the grill. It's things like halloumi and panella and other cheeses that you can actually grill and griddle. And It is remarkable exactly how tasty they are as a taco filling and other things. It's really good. So I highly encourage halloumi. And thanks, everybody.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Christian Garibay, Jimmy Sierfoss, Luis Licon, Alexis Kenyon, and John Lindorf for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for A Public Affair with Tish Buford and then Radio Book Club with Maeve Conran. That's coming up just after these news headlines from the BBC.